Purple Space Confident Conversations, hosted by Kate Nash, OBE, with guest Michelle Irvin, founder and CEO of Career and Chronic Illness.
I first met Michelle on LinkedIn. It's a great place to meet fellow travellers. I was immediately struck by her ability to offer practical ways by which we can manage chronic illness while simultaneously navigating our careers. And I was struck by her warmth and ability to experience gratitude through the challenges we may face. Michelle, as her website hints at, really is a true pioneer in the chronic illness space. She runs her own consultancy and mentors incredible women around the world, teaching individuals how to create a life filled with love, meaningful work, and deep personal power. She tells how she is driven by a mission to de-shame and transform conversations around illness. In our conversation, you'll hear her thoughts about how inner confidence relates to our capacity to stay deeply connected to what we are thinking, feeling, and the actions we want to take. Michelle speaks powerfully about her life before and after chronic illness. She started her working life in financial services straight after school, returning to university to study philosophy. She then moves into the civil service in Australia and works in a vibrant environment before she then becomes chronically ill. Her journey in terms of navigating and managing that, gaining a deep appreciation of what we need to do to navigate other people's stuff and then carving out a purpose-driven life, is a fascinating story. You will be riveted and come away with some ideas to try when trying to make sense of our new identities, especially with chronic illness. I particularly loved her description of finding sovereignty or self-reference power, sometimes referred to as agency. These interviews are brought to you with thanks to remarkable people choosing to share their learning about inner confidence so that others can learn faster. This tranche of 6 films in our first series are also brought to you thanks to LSEG, who are working to create a culture of belonging for everybody, and accessibility is a key part of that. Once you have listened, I ask one thing from you. Send the link to 5 others who you think might be able to pass on the messages to 5 others. We are on a mission at Purple Space to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence, a strong expectation of a positive outcome, and to share the practical things we can do to create and navigate our working worlds while managing disability and all the things that comes with that. Enjoy this film. Michelle, inner confidence is the bedrock from which we launch and sustain our careers. What does inner confidence mean for you? And what would you like the viewers tuning in to this conversation take away from our discussion?
So I think inner confidence is your capacity to stay really deeply connected to what you're thinking, feeling, the actions you want to take, and also what your relationship to others is. And for me, I always like to think of it as, am I sitting, lying, standing, whatever is the appropriate sort of position for me, on my own sacred ground? Am I deeply connected to who I am, rather than off over with everybody else's thoughts and feelings and what I think they think and all of that? And so what I would love people to take away from this discussion is that you can 100% trust you. When you are connected to yourself, you can trust you no matter what you are feeling in that moment. If you can find your ground, you can always pause and then speak or then act. And that's what inner confidence is to me.
Wonderful. So let's move into our conversation. You're an incredible woman. You're currently the founding chief executive of Career and Chronic Illness International, and you've had an illustrious career, which we will touch on. But take us back to the start. Take us back to the Michelle who was starting her career and some of the things that you learned in those early days and indeed along the way, your experience with chronic illness?
Yes, I think there's sort of two phases. There's before chronic illness and after chronic illness. So before chronic illness, I actually started in financial services right out of school. And one of the reasons for that that I think is important to share in our career trajectory is that my parents couldn't afford to send me to university. So if I wanted to go, I was going to have to pay for it. So I went to work, and as a young person in a very big financial institution, and I was right there just after the 1990s financial crash. So it was a very sort of frightening time. And what I learned in that phase was how naive I was about the world, and that money really was something that people paid a lot of attention to, and that it could facilitate extraordinary things. And then through that process, I ended up being one of those young people in the early 90s in a redundancy at 21. And what that did was facilitate my pathway into university, because now I was able to do that for myself. And I went to university having worked for 5 years or so. And I was like, oh my goodness, you can study? This is really fun. So I wasn't there on a career trajectory. I was there for, what do I want? This is a real pleasure. And out of that process, I chose to study philosophy. And I did that because I was just fascinated with wisdom, and I was really interested in how people managed their inner world and what we did about power internally. And then as that process moved, I graduated. I moved into a graduate program within the civil service in Australia. And then that took me from one state to the next state. And I landed in what to me was the pinnacle of my career in my early 30s, where I was working for the Department of Premier and Cabinet, which for audiences, I guess, in the Westminster system, it would be the prime ministers, but at a state level. And I was having the time of my life. Like, I was dressing, the work was really interesting. It was all social policy. I did everything from bioethics to human services to aged care to education. It was a vibrant, vibrant environment. And then, out of my vanity, I asked my local general practitioner about the dark circles under my eyes that at 33, 34, makeup would not cover. No matter what I did, I was like, what is this? Is there anything you've got? Like, is there an antibiotic? Like, what is it? And that started a diagnosis process that fortunately saved my life fairly early on one level, but absolutely changed the course of my experience of life.
Tell us more. Move us through those moments, those early months, early years, and how did it change your thinking about what next for you work-wise?
The first thing is that I transitioned into another job to give myself a bit more flexibility. And in doing so, I had no idea what was going to happen. So I started off on this diagnosis process that took quite a long period of time. I had genetic testing. They kept getting these sort of, you know, no, it's not this, no, it's not that. And I'm like, it's just dark circles. Like, it's not a big deal. But in fact, it was a big deal. What we were actually doing, which I didn't realize in the diagnosis process, is we were eliminating things. And it came down to a diagnosis of an autoimmune condition affecting my liver. And that's what the dark circles were. It was a very, very early sign. The issue was, as a young person, I was, you know, walking to and from the office 30 minutes door to door. I was going to yoga regularly. I was doing hip hop dance classes because that was a phase that was happening at that time. And I felt robustly well. And then they started me on medication. And then I slept 18 hours a day. And that was it. Like, I couldn't get up. I could basically shower, hop on public transport. And by the time I got to the office, I was beyond exhausted and had to go straight home again. So it was a very confusing experience. And one of the differences, I think, in my personal story is that the liver, you don't actually feel well until it's way too late usually. But because I was diagnosed so early, the contrast was I was well off treatment, super well, and on treatment, I was just beyond exhausted. So all of that had a huge impact when thinking about work because I couldn't do it and people were empathetic, but I just didn't fit the identity of who I was and the job that I had taken. And I thought maybe this is going to get better, you know, we'll try a month or two. And it just kept going. So then I had to make some other decisions by the time I really had to reconcile that this is what life was like with that treatment.
What did that do to your own feelings about your career trajectory?
So I felt that I had worked really, really hard to get to where I was at. I felt extremely vulnerable and I was very frightened because part of that diagnosis was that this was a life-threatening condition and that without treatment I would have 5 years. And so it was a very heavy load. And work was my financial security. It was my relationship with others. I'd moved to a city for my career. So all of my networks and light friendships, I would say, were there. I hadn't been established there very long. And I was a long way from home and I didn't want to go home because this is why I'd moved. So it was a time of confusion. And it was also a time where I had to consistently say, that's not possible and I can't do that, and work with the empathy, sympathy, questioning, confusion in my colleagues and leaders' eyes as well.
Tell me a bit about the things that you learned about yourself. I think particularly in terms of building confidence and resilience and moving through that experience, and also what did you learn about others, their capacity to receive information that may leave them with some uncertainty as to what you could or could not deliver at work.
Yes, and I think the thing about this arc is that it went on for quite a long period of time. This went on for 4 or 5 years.
So you're still working at this
stage? I was still working, but there was a lot of negotiation. We would try different drugs, different treatment. So you would do 3 months of that and then you would have the same experience until I made the decision that this was absolutely intolerable for me. It was incredibly hard to reconcile that without taking the treatment, I could just almost instantly feel a lot better because my immune system wasn't being suppressed and my body wasn't filled with steroids. So I actually really leaned on my philosophical training and I was like, okay, this is life. What quality of life do I want? And I also leaned into what is the good death? And that's where I was internally. And my quality of life was, I want to do things in this world. I want to be connected with others and I want to express the talents and gifts and resources that I have. It also required me to find what I would really call a backbone because it was no longer possible to prioritize some people-pleasing habits or the fear of other people's opinions over the health choices. It just was no longer possible to do that because I didn't have the bandwidth. I also found that I was incredibly vulnerable at work and I'm wrestling with this internal world and then everybody else is going on with their life, with their mortgages, with their kids. And that just wasn't the life I was having. I was wrestling with what's the good life? What's the good death? What do I want to do with my life? And so I think others have always found me, I have a deep nature and I'm always interested in the big questions and I'm interested in doing work that is enjoyable. I don't see any other reason to be here if we're not going to do things that feel uplifting and joyous and connecting. And because I'd had that very early part of my career where I'd gone immediately from school to work, And then I was able to study. I knew life could take these twists and turns and be very different. So the way that I worked with other people's reactions was I started to orientate back to myself and what was important for me, and then start to speak from that internal dialogue externally, rather than trying to work out what they needed, because what they needed was actually less practical than what I needed, because they didn't have all the information. What they actually needed was my information about my capacity, and that would enable us to have a very strong and pragmatic conversation. And in the end, I had to work that out. That is just the way it is. I had to work out what my capacity was.
It's a story, of course, we hear again and again from those individuals who acquire chronic illness through the course, particularly of their work in life, when they have to renegotiate how they deliver their work and indeed how much of their work they deliver. So tell us how you went on to subsequently found this remarkable organisation that you're heading up. What was the story for you to get to that point?
So this was the most unexpected pathway and twist and turn of life. And it came out of the deepest, most difficult experiences of my life. So in this trajectory, because I'm now 53, so this is a very long arc that I've been traveling with chronic conditions, I ended up in a place where there was a moment where a new drug came out, I had a new clinician. At this point, I was just being monitored. And there was a moment where they did a biopsy of my liver. I went into the hospital, you know, just from work, off for the day, you know, in the afternoon, popped over to the clinic, got sat down by my clinician, and he looked at me and said, "You do not leave hospital today without treatment. It starts today." And I was like, "Ooh, okay, he's very, very serious." And I had in my head made an agreement with that clinician that the day he said I take treatment that I would. And that's how we had navigated this experience I was having. So I phoned work, you know, obviously in shock, but also reconciling, okay, what are the next steps? And said, "I don't know when I'll be back. This is the advice I've got. And that's all I know at this point in time." And I knew the treatment would be difficult. It's also the case that at that time, I also knew that some of the treatments that they would give me had a significant mental health component, and that I said to him, "I will not take that drug without a psychiatrist consult, because that drug has a significant impact on my mental health." And he had a psychiatrist in the public hospital to me within 45 minutes. And I then was like, "Oh, he's really serious." So it's, "I really don't leave today without treatment." And so making that phone call to the office was one of shock. There was nothing to say. That was it. We were done. I didn't know what was going to happen, when I'd be back. I was deeply financially concerned because I had no idea how finances were going to flow. And I caught the bus back from the hospital to my apartment. So I was scared about my health. I was scared about my drug treatment, which was very serious, and I had to then arrange to stay with other people because I couldn't be on my own with the medication. And I was afraid financially. And one of the things that happens with work, which is so magical and we don't talk about often enough, that is that we make these incredible relationships with other people. And in one of the earlier stages of my career, I had this incredible public service mentor, and he had overseen and really guided my career into these incredible jobs. And he had retired, and we had sort of weekly check-ins. So he knew everything, and I phoned him from the hospital, and he said, "Right, don't worry, send your bank account details. We're going to immediately put money into your account. So I don't want you to be concerned about money." And that in itself, I think work is extraordinary. It can be very difficult. It can be filled with robust conflict. And it's also the place where we spend a lot of time, we make a lot of connection, And the truth is, some of those connections are lifelong friendships and supports. And we don't talk about that enough because we're basically incubating ourselves for personal growth in the middle of our work. And that was one of the outcomes of those relationships for me.
That's so powerful, Michelle. That is so powerful. I want to tuck into that a little. I mean, you must have drawn on the support of many through those months. How did that feel? Because we're quite often shy about asking for the help, whether it's financial or any other type of help.
This was way more difficult than anything else. And I have always used my experience with a chronic condition or any other experience to say, how can I be more deeply empowered through this experience? And how can I be more deeply connected to myself so that I know me? Because when I know what's going on for me, I have a lot more choices. And I had been raised to be completely self-sufficient, and to ask for help was basically the most shameful thing you could do. And I understand why my parents had that perspective from their own experiences. So I was in an incredibly difficult emotional and mental space where I had to, in many ways, very quickly get a new parameter around asking for help because shame was not going to get the job done. And I had to find a way to acknowledge the shame, find new thought patterns that actually gave me a way to move forward, and then actually action them, which is a whole different thing. You might be able to think your way into something, but taking action and the vulnerability, I had to reach out and say, I can't get my groceries, I can't clean my house, I can't do my washing, there's nothing I can do, basically. And roster friends. I didn't have family. I was thousands of miles from family. Australia is a very, very big country. And I set up a roster for people to come and visit because I was alone, to come and manage the chores. A girlfriend of mine hired a cleaner for me out as a very generous act of support. And there was a roster of people who went into the market and got food for me. And there was a roster of people who took me to medical appointments. And the team at the office sent the biggest box of chocolate I have ever seen and lots of just best wishes. And for me, that was warm, but I had left the office behind because now I was in an insurance conversation. And so I had actually transitioned psychologically out of work into an insurance dialogue.
Which I was thinking about the work that you do now, and of course you support and help women with chronic illness to navigate these difficult moments and to have the careers or not that they wish. What would be the lessons that you have learned along the way that you support others to understand and to learn?
Yes. So the number one thing I would say is, I'm sorry to tell you, but it's an inside job. And it's not you alone. There are lots and lots of tools, but you do need to work out in some way what your capacity is. And one of the tools that I think is helpful for people is that we often find that we either think of ourselves as well or not well. We're either up or down. And that leaves us feeling really disempowered. I prefer to think of it as that I have a circle of capacity that expands and contracts. So when one of my chronic conditions flares, then that circle is contracted, and then I can be clear about what my capacity is in a contracted circle. And then expansion is a bonus. And that stops me from thinking I'm either well or not well. And it also is a really useful way to explain to colleagues and leaders that this is an expansion and contraction, not a well or not well conversation. The other thing that I had to work out is that we have a really rubbish story about illness, and it comes with this thing of if you're unwell, you should get well, which doesn't work with chronic conditions. So I kept thinking I was going to get well and waiting for when I would be well, and I did myself a disservice. I didn't know that if I'd actually thought about this as a disability or dynamic disability, I would have given myself a lot more space, and I would have utilized a whole lot more organizational support than carrying it all on my shoulders and trying to mentally push myself through to get well. And so I always encourage people to actually think about where does this fit in terms of a disability policy at the organizational level. The third thing about that narrative is that I needed to work out how to have healthy professional boundaries. Because in the early stages, I was like in the vulnerability and sort of, you know, explaining everything all on the table, and that was making me way more vulnerable. Nobody needed that level of information, but I was trying to tell them all the things I was doing to try and get well, to prove that I was trying to get well. And so I had to stop that behavior. It wasn't good for me. It wasn't good for work. What I needed to do was be very clear about capacity and that I was following medical advice. And so that is what I shifted my language to. Is this is the medical advice, and I'm following that advice, and this is my capacity. And what that did was depersonalize it from me trying to have this relationship with everybody else about me to the actual appropriate relationship, which was, I really am following medical advice. And when they say take this treatment, I take the treatment. And when they say, no, that's too much, I follow that. And that served me so much better. It took a long time for me to work this out for myself, which is why I'm so thrilled to share this with people and to really mentor people through this process, as well as do this in groups and organizations so that we have a safe container to talk about all the things that nobody else knows about that you're actually trying to manage at work. And we can work on your inner skills in a robust way so that you turn up to the conversation actually feeling confident.
Wise, wise words. Michelle, if you were to look back, I'm thinking about the Michelle pre-diagnosis, and you've come a long way since then. You've done a lot of work on yourself and now with your clients, your customers. So what would you whisper in Michelle's younger ears, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, I think this question is really important, particularly as we start to get older, we accumulate wisdom based on our experience. And I think the softest thing I would say to young me, who was, you know, yes, she was fit and healthy, but she was still trying to navigate the world, I would say to her, everything is going to be okay. Everything is already okay. And you are 100% okay right now. And that's what I would say to her. And I'm curious, Kate, in your own navigation, because you've navigated these chronic conditions as well, I wonder what would you say, or what are the key things you've learned then that would help you now if you were in that position too?
It's a great question. So, yes, I navigated chronic rheumatoid arthritis, Still's disease. You know, a woman now hit 60 last year, hey. But then at a 15-year-old, you know, as I look back, young, running around the hockey pitch, and acquired quite a dramatic onset of a disease that I never expected. What would I say to her? Very similar, very similar. It's a sense of life is unfolding as it should. My friends and my family know me for saying often, daily, it is what it is.
Yes.
And I suppose what I mean by that is there are some things in life that you cannot change. And while often for me, pain and discomfort and immobility has been a core feature of my life, the joy I get is from other places. And it's a bit like your expression of connection and purpose and, you know, understanding the gifts and the strengths that we have and how we're going to play them out in the world, which for me was never going to be as an athlete. So, yeah, very similar, very similar. And I see that a lot and hear that a lot from others with chronic illness, perhaps more so than those illnesses or diseases or disabilities or experiences that perhaps are more static.
Yes, I think the thing about this conversation is I don't think either of us set out to be in, you know, the disability and chronic illness world. Like, that was not a career path that I ever thought of in a way, and I certainly never expected to be where I am now. However, it is the making of me. I always say I just had to learn how to make lemonade because I absolutely was just not going to sit with lemons. I refused to say that's it. This is all there is for me. And while that requires an internal experience, I was also very fortunate that I was able to find pathways that had external support. And I'm curious, did you find external support too in the process?
Yeah, and mostly for me, I mean, I chose to go into politics of disablement and have worked closely with Westminster and other parliamentarians around the world and have been very active in the process of delivering legislation in different jurisdictions. So the connections I had with other advocates, I think, have been the greatest importance to me for two reasons. One, because of making sense of the external barriers. You know, today we're talking about those internal barriers. I love your expression, it's an inside job. Yeah. And I think sometimes at our cost, we only focus on some of the external barriers that exist, which is necessary and proper and a real necessity, but it does require internal work. So yeah, connections, great advocates, others who have worked in this sector have brought great meaning and understanding.
Yeah. I think we are meaning-making beings.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about the internal process because it forges you, but there are skills you can learn. And I think there's this shift from thinking about I'm not that type of person or I'm not this, and then I'm having this real crossroads with an experience that is extremely difficult. There is skills development here, particularly around your career. And I really want to share that with everybody. This is not an innate process. You actually can learn these skills. They are quite simple. It's just a different perspective. And like you, the people I've discovered our relationship through this course of, you know, uncharted territory, finding all of us our way. And what does it mean now around work and career? It means something very different than what it meant 15, 18 years ago. I think we're in a very open moment in culture. And I'm extremely optimistic about what inclusion looks like and what is now possible. And I'm particularly optimistic because here we are having this conversation.
I love it. Michelle, you know, at Purple Space, we're on a mission to build a universal and global definition of inner confidence for people with disabilities. And for us, it's a strong expectation of a positive outcome. And in support of that, we're looking to create the resources, the assets, the publications, the podcasts, the films like today to support people to understand how. So as part of that, the Confident Conversation series that we've created, I know you've read them.
Yes.
We talk about the six fundamentals and the six hurdles.
Yes.
Which of those spoke to you?
I think the biggest thing for me is identity, and it's twofold. One is identity internally, like who am I and what is going on? And then as things continue, who am I now at work and who am I in these relationships? And just this week, I caught up with a friend who had been, you know, we'd both worked in the civil service and he's now very senior at the BBC. And he knew me before any of this happened. Just before that tipping point, he came to the UK. And as we sat down and we're catching up, and I'm incredibly well now because I have treatment that works, I'm still in a conversation with, you know, living and dying as we all are. And I have a lot more internal capacity as well. But I was sitting with him and thinking, oh, see, to him, I'm just somebody 20 years later because he hadn't run the trajectory with me. But to everybody else who had been my colleague in those 20 years in between, I was the person who was incredibly unwell or uncertain or came to work in sunglasses, or some people would use, you know, inspiration, which never really kind of sat well with me. I had no choice. This is kind of, I just had to work it out. And I think that identity internally and externally has been the hardest thing to work out, and staying with it to work out what was authentically true for me is the gold. It is everything.
Wonderful. Michelle, I have just two questions. We could stay here forever. However, Two more questions. One is, what advice would you give to someone who has a choice as to whether to self-identify with the experience of chronic illness or disability or not? And of course, some of us will have an unseen disability,
yes,
like yourself. So for those individuals who are struggling to understand the benefits or the advantages or the things that will flow,
yes,
more positively from sharing, how would you encourage them, if at all? Because this is personal choice.
Yeah, I think for me, the question is that I would encourage you to think about this word that I love, which is sovereignty. And sovereignty means self-reference power. That's literally the definition of it. And so if you start with that, it's what is going to support my sovereignty or agency. As I said, I wish that I had thought of myself having a disability and access those policies and also being able to have that conversation with a manager. I think that would have made my world a bit easier. I identify as myself. I definitely identify with chronic illness, but it's something that I've, you know, just could not stand the definition of or the conversation about 20 years ago. But because it's become my work, I'm in love with it. And I'm in love with it because I spend my day with bright, savvy, creative, intelligent people who are really finding their way through something with deep stamina and are usually filled with love and joy and laughter amongst the tears and the sorrow. And so that's what chronic illness means to me. It means that kind of world. So I think for anybody struggling with the conversation internally, I think with identity, it's start with agency and self first, and then look at what's an appropriate pathway for you that is most supportive for you.
Wonderful. So our last question, and we have a tradition where we ask the previous interviewee to jot down a question for the next interviewee. So your question is, when is the best time to start a confident conversation?
I think the best time to start a confident conversation is when you've practiced it with somebody else who's an ally and when you've grounded and settled yourself a little about why am I having this conversation? What's the outcome that I'm looking for? And can I be with the discomfort of whatever the other person goes through while having this conversation? And I think when you can find your way through some of those answers first and you can test it with somebody, then have it with somebody else. But start with your allies and your network and your peer support or a good mentor or a psychotherapist. Whoever is the right person for you to test with, start there.
That's neat. It allows that sense of practice because we're forever becoming.
Yes.
And sometimes a bit like the Goldilocks and the Three Bears, we might say something one way, it doesn't quite land.
Yes.
Whereas you perfect, try again, improve that brand, yes, identity almost.
Yes, and it's part of the becoming. You learn it en route. Mm. And I think we all think we're going to get there and it'll just happen and we'll just pop out of the box. But the beauty of your experience and my experience is we are who we are, mm, because we learned it en route, who we were becoming.
Wonderful. Michelle, thank you so much for a wonderful, wonderful conversation. You're doing the most extraordinary work and we look forward to seeing how you continue to sprinkle your wonderful magic into our worlds. So the tradition is you jot down a question for the next interviewee. If you could do that for us.
I will. I'll have to translate it for you.
Michelle, thank you.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Purple Space is on a mission to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence for employees with disabilities. Our organisation members can access a growing suite of learning tools in order to navigate our working worlds while managing disability, deafness, mental health and neurodivergence. Notice the fundamentals. Remember the hurdles. Take individual action. For more information, visit our website www.purplespace.org.